morning. We're delighted to welcome today students from Edgewood High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming with us today. You may be seated, please. The students are here with a program entitled Court with Class. The State Bar and this court sponsor a program that invites students from around the state to come join us for an oral argument. If the students agree to come, then they are given materials relating to the case that we're about to hear, and they are invited to stay and meet with a justice after the second case that we will hear today. The subject of the discussion will be the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in these cases. Everyone is invited to join the discussion after the second case. Now that we've met you, I would like to introduce the court to you all. Starting on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Justice Gableman will meet with you after the second case. Then comes Justice Patience Robinsack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. I will now call our first case, 07-AP-2307-CR, State versus Michael Scott Long. Representing Mr. Long is Attorney Joseph L. Summers. Mr. Summers.
Pleases the court on behalf of Mr. Long. Today, actually, when I was walking out the door of my house, something happened that actually, I think, sort of best illustrates where the state's argument would go if you took it to its logical end. As I was walking out, my wife actually grabbed me by the wrist and yanked me back toward her because she thought that my tie was askew. Now, if that had taken place, and basically my wife had been prosecuted because under the theory that I didn't want to be held back, if you took the state's argument, that would be false imprisonment. Now obviously that is absurd, but actually that is very close to what the state is arguing in this case. False imprisonment is being reduced in this matter to what was a simple hug. Now, we don't know exactly how long the hug was, but we do know that it was extremely brief in time. And that's it. That's really the entire basis of the state's case to how they have gotten to false imprisonment. And of course, why stop there? Why not just say if someone's basically trying to get out of the room and someone puts their arm in front of them and says, hey, you can't leave? That too would be false imprisonment if you took the state's case to, if you took the state's argument to its logical end. That's just absurd, but that's where you'd be headed and if basically you accept their argument in this case. That isn't the law. I mean, that hopefully isn't the law, and if it is the law, there'd be a lot of people in the state that would be could be prosecuted for actions that they would have never conceived was criminal, let alone felonious conduct. In regards to, as well, into the the second degree sexual assault conviction. What we have in this case is something that is pretty much the same as well. Again, if you took the state's argument, again, if let's say I'm walking out of this room, someone says to me, hey Joe, give me a hug, we have a hug, and I pinch that person, let's say, in the behind after that, that would be second degree sexual assault. Now again, that would be absurd as well. That's what you'd be talking about. The hugging aspect would be basically can be used say that the element of force or the threat of force had taken place. That too would be absurd. And again, you would be reducing the law to something that is absurd. And that's what the state has argued. If you take the logic, you take the argument to the logical end, that's where it takes place.
How long do you think you have to have a bear hug, a forceful hug, to have it to imprison it? And how long or in what circumstances do you think it isn't sexual assault, and when is it?
First of all,
they didn't know each other, right?
No, they didn't know each other.
Didn't know this woman.
Right. That's not one of the elements.
No, I understand that.
Right.
You're not arguing she consented.
Actually, in regard to the second degree,
right.
We are arguing that there isn't sufficient evidence that she did not consent to the hook. We are not arguing, though, that there was not sufficient evidence to convict him of fourth degree.
Okay. So how long does he have to hug her before, and let's assume an unwanted hug, before it's false imprisonment?
Well, I think by definition, it can't be false imprisonment for a hug at all. I mean, again, to say that you are hugging somebody and now you have met the elements of false imprisonment is rendering false imprisonment by itself an absurd.
Well, suppose you say, instead of hug, restrained movement.
Again, well, actually, if you say hug, I mean, if you're saying that the person had a gun and it kept somebody in a room, that's something different. But if the person is just in the context of somebody just having a hug that is, by definition, meant to be short in time, I say that you cannot meet the elements of false imprisonment.
What are the elements of false imprisonment? The defendant restrained the victim. The defendant restrained the victim intentionally. The victim was restrained without her consent. The defendant had no lawful authority to restrain the victim. And the defendant knew that the victim did not consent and knew that he did not have lawful authority. So,
right. Now, again, take everything that you just put forth. That's meant if somebody just grabs my wrist. By just grabbing the wrist, all of those elements are met. If you take it, if let's say you define them in a very absurd, legalistic manner. Just by grabbing my wrist.
Well, I would submit that your wife has lawful authority in that kind of situation.
My wife, I would agree with you. Let's say that it was just anybody. Let's say I'm walking out of here and somebody here wants to ask me a question. Let's say one of these high school kids decides, hey, you know what? I was sort of curious about that argument that he made. So as I'm walking out, he grabs me by my wrist to stop, and he does stop. Under that reading of it, he would have committed false imprisonment if you define those terms in this legalistic, absurd way. And that's just, again, that would just reduce the law to something that'd be totally absurd. And, you know, it isn't...
Isn't that an argument to make the prosecutor?
Actually, you know, Your Honor, I guess today, in a lot of courts, I think that you would probably, if this court especially rules, let's say, in the state's favor today, you'd be prohibited almost from making that argument.
Now, isn't your argument then sufficiency of the evidence?
Actually, we are arguing sufficiency of the evidence, and we have made this as part of this is one of our aspects of that argument. We're saying that the only evidence that there is this hug, and that's not enough. But back to what you had just put forth, if you rule in the state's favor, since attorneys are not permitted to argue the law in front of juries, you couldn't make that argument. You'd be prohibited from making that argument.
Mr. Summers, I'd like to focus on what the trial court judge had in front of him when he made his determination that there were these requisite charges. The court had the complaint, yes?
I mean the
Minnesota
complaint from the other state, yes.
Yes. Did the court have the plea colloquy of the Minnesota court?
My understanding is that all that they had was the complaint.
Did the court have any judgments of conviction?
I believe that he did have the judgment of conviction, but I think for what took place in court, maybe the state can correct. that was the complaint. They did not have any transcript of the Minnesota proceedings.
So how do we know if the Minnesota conviction is based upon all the facts in the criminal complaint?
I would agree, except the fact of the matter is I can only cut in my client's favor. Because right now you can't guess facts to add to it.
I don't disagree with you. I'm trying to figure out what the judge knew and how you can...
No, that is a central aspect of what we put forth. All that you have from that complaint in regards to what would have been the felonious criminal conduct, let's say, of the sexual assault, which is what the judge said, is that he yanked down her pants and he slapped her in the behind. That's it.
That's if we use the criminal complaint.
And that's all we have. We don't have anything beyond that.
We don't know if he admitted to the facts in the criminal complaint. Is that true or is that false?
Well, I think what we know is that he pled out to that offense. Typically, I would assume, I guess, in the state of Minnesota, as in the state of Wisconsin, they can use, let's say, the criminal complaint as a factual basis. And so what I would be putting forth is we are definitely bound by the criminal complaint alone. We can't go beyond the criminal complaint. We have to be bound by what's in the criminal complaint, and that has to be it in total.
Well, if I understand you correctly, you think this court can use all the facts in the criminal complaint?
Well, I don't think there's enough there. I think that I don't think the conduct of pulling her pants down and slapping her butt is enough to say he committed second-degree sexual assault. I mean, I'll tell you what, I think this court could understand this. If someone was charged, let's say, in this state, second-degree sexual assault, and that the entire facts that were alleged were that you had pulled down a woman's shorts and you had slapped her in the behind, it'd be a pretty terrible trial attorney that would be advising that client, you don't have any chance of winning on second-degree sexual assault.
But Mr. Summers, that's not really all of the salient facts that are contained within that criminal complaint.
It is, though, for the second-degree sexual assault.
Well, isn't there some context alleged in that complaint in regard to your client's partial nudity and other comments that he had been making right immediately prior to the conduct that you just described?
Right. And that, Your Honor, is all...
I'm sorry, did you say yes or no?
I say right, but I'm saying you're actually making a different point, because what the judge found, what he had to find, was that what my client did in Minnesota was basically undisputed, to be honest, reasonable doubt, second-degree sexual assault.
And I understood your response to Justice Ziegler to indicate that this court could, in fact, use the factual allegations in the criminal complaint, but it is your position that the facts contained therein are not sufficient to serve as a basis for the sexual assault, unless I misapprehended your argument.
That is correct, second degree. I would put forth that even the facts that you were asserting right now, which are contained in the complaint, I mean, there was this indecent exposure and he's on her bed and so on. Those are not, though, facts that would support a conviction for second-degree sexual support.
Was he convicted of second-degree sexual assault in the Minnesota case?
No, he wasn't.
What was he convicted?
Actually, in Minnesota, they have a different law. Basically, he was convicted for a burglary conviction, which they define differently than we define it in the state of Wisconsin.
I understand that, but what was the underlying, there was another charge that went down at the same time as the burglary, and what was the charge in the complaint at that time?
It was a misdemeanor. It was a fourth degree, it's misdemeanor sexual conduct, but it's fourth degree in the state of Minnesota. So Minnesota did not consider the sexual aspect of his conduct to be a...
Did he plead to the same thing that he was charged with in the crime underlying the eventual burglary conviction in Minnesota?
He did not. He put out to the burglary. Did he plead out to the misdemeanor sexual assault? I guess at this time, I'm not quite sure of that. He did not plead out to any felonious sexual conduct in the state of Minnesota. He wasn't charged in Minnesota with any felonious sexual conduct.
Well, is it important for us to know whether he pled to the same thing that he was charged with if we're going to look at the complaint for facts to support whatever happened?
Well, actually, Your Honor, that's all. That means I should win by definition. Because he wasn't even charged with a felony. He was only charged with a misdemeanor.
I'm talking about facts, because in Wisconsin, we're trying to line up the facts of whatever he did that resulted in a charge in Minnesota with similar facts and what they would result in Wisconsin. And my question to you is it important for us to know whether he pled to the same crime that he was charged with?
And I'm putting forth is that by asking the question, we should automatically win.
Well, you have to first answer the question, which is it important for us to know whether he pled to the same crime underlying the burglary in Minnesota that he was charged with? That's the question. Is that important for us to know?
Yes and no. And this is why, Your Honor.
Okay.
The bottom line is, you're saying, if I understand it correctly, you're saying if he put out to a charge in Minnesota, it would be reasonable for us to take that and then say, here's what he put out to Minnesota. This is what it means here in the state of Wisconsin. But the problem, that's exactly why we should win. Because in Minnesota, they didn't even charge him with anything close to what the judge said. This is what it means in the state of Wisconsin. He was never even charged. He couldn't have possibly put out to anything that would have been the equivalent of second-degree sexual assault because he wasn't charged with anything even close to that. And so that's why you can't use that.
Mr. Summers, I'm interested in zeroing in on the sentencing hearing in Wisconsin. My understanding is the judge has the complaints from Minnesota. Was your client in any way contesting the Minnesota convictions? Was he contesting whether or not the third strike law applied to him? I'm talking about through counsel, but also individually. Was he saying, this isn't true, this isn't correct, I wasn't convicted of this, the statute doesn't apply to me? What was the argument made to the circuit court?
No, Your Honor, the argument made was that the third strike law should not apply to him. And the argument made was basically the same argument we're making here, is that the conduct that he was convicted of in the state of Minnesota cannot be considered to be the equivalent of second-degree sexual assault or a felony. What the judge found. The judge found by just reading that one paragraph that basically it's the same as if he had committed second degree sexual assault.
Are you satisfied when you review the statutes that the time frames required for the third strike law to apply line up here? There's a certain sequence of events that's supposed to occur, as you know.
Right.
Do those line up? Are you satisfied that the time frames in terms of the conviction dates and violation dates, assuming that everything else was okay, do they line up so that there's no question this law would apply?
Yes, if let's say he had committed the equivalent of a second degree sexual assault or some felonious, something that was under the statute for the state of Wisconsin for this law to apply, yes. That's not our argument. We're not making any argument that it was improper due to the time this being prior to the law or something like that.
Your argument basically is that the Minnesota convictions just don't equate with Wisconsin offenses. Is that basically right?
Right, and to go one step further, in our under our law right now, it has to be the Wisconsin judge had to be able to make his conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt. And what we're saying is that paragraph, all by itself, which is really all that there is, just cannot put it beyond a reasonable doubt.
You think the Apprendi case applies here? U.S. Supreme Court decision in regard to increasing penalties based on information that's not found by a jury, but rather is being found by the judge. Is there any relevance to Apprendi in this case?
Actually, Ron, that's an excellent argument, and I got to tell you, I wish I would have thought of that prior to you just asking that question. That is an excellent argument, and I wish I didn't see it in those terms. And I'm just thinking right now, sort of like off the top of my head, but I didn't see it in those terms. I wish I would have considered it in those terms. I think that off the top of my head, that you could make that argument. Well, no, I guess it gets tough is the jury in Wisconsin, though, never had in front of it anything that relates to the
third strike law.
Right, what happened in the criminal complaint. So I guess I would be shot down on that aspect. It's a legal question, I think, that the judge would have to make under Wisconsin
law. I'm going to follow up on Justice Crooks. In this case, he is being charged with and sentenced with a felony. You don't think that he should have been, but let us just say that conviction holds. Let us look at the repeat. What conviction of record and unreversed is your client attributed, or what conviction is attributed to your client? What Minnesota conviction is attributed to your client? Two convictions.
Correct.
That have to be upheld by the Circuit Court and us. Which are the two? Just give me the convictions.
He had two cases.
Date.
It could be laid out in our brief. There were two Minnesota convictions that have been put forth by the state who have met the first prong of the.
Which ones are they?
And he had two Minnesota convictions. One of them we do not dispute.
Which one is it?
That was he had another burglary. He had another burglary case where his conduct, I thought, had gone further, and the court had found that in his other case he had met.
Which was charged in the complaint against him?
He was
is that where the repeater is charged in the complaint?
Yes.
Okay. So the state has to prove the ones that are in the complaint. Is that right?
Okay. There was one that we don't dispute.
Which one is it? Just tell me.
That is the one where his conviction was in Washington County. That victim testified at his trial, actually, as an other act's evidence. I mean, as an other act's.
Okay, there was a burglary. Is that what it is? What date was that?
The date of it. I don't know. I can tell you what the conduct was and why we didn't test it.
What's the conduct?
What's that?
What's the conduct?
Conduct basically was he was thrusting his penis up against her butt and her groin and asking her repeatedly and asking her if he was hitting her spot. And for me, I believe that would be second degree. And so that's why that has never been contested. The trial attorney made that determination. I think he made the right determination. So that's number one. That was the first conviction.
That's a comparable felony to Wisconsin.
Yeah, I believe you could. I believe that's
second
degree.
I believe it was Justice Ziegler who asked you early on whether the record had copies of the complaints in these Minnesota cases.
Yes.
And so there would be a complaint of this sexual assault that you have just described.
Yes, and on the basis of that complaint, I believe that would have been sufficient. Okay. If he was convicted on the facts in that complaint, I believe then that any attorney in the state would say to him,
and
would
the complaint have the date of the offense?
I'm sure. Oh, actually, it was January. He was convicted on January 7th, 2004.
Yes, but would the complaint have the date of the offense?
Sure.
What was it?
I don't have it right in front of me, but I'm positive that the complaint would have had the date of the offense.
Well, it would have been sometime during 03, unless Minnesota is very fast.
Right, and actually that actually would be probably in the, pretty soon that would be in the record, because again, that witness testified at his trial as an other acts witness.
Is there, would there be any, would you dispute that the offense occurred on March 23rd, 2003?
That sounds like it could be correct. I mean, I guess if you're asking that question, I'm assuming you have something right in front of you or you've seen something that says that it did.
Good assumption.
Right. And I guess if you would now connect the dots to tell me the significance of that, I would appreciate it.
All right. Okay, that's the Washington County. I want the second offense.
That's number one.
What is the second offense?
I would Justice Ziegler have some document there?
The complaint is, I just have the complaint. It's March 26, 03.
All right. What's the second offense?
The second one, he was convicted on December 18th, 2003.
But when did that offense occur?
And again, I have the, I don't have that right in front of me. I have, that's when the conviction was.
Right. And what offense was that? We'll come back to the date.
That's the one where she, that's the one where it involved the hugging. And that's the one where he went into her room, he exposed himself, got on the bed. What we believe is the only conduct that would relate to the fourth aspect was sexual. The sexual in the fourth aspect was he pulled down her pants and he grabbed her buttocks. And that's all that the complaint says.
Would you take issue with the fact that that offense occurred on March 26, 2003.
I do not. Again, I could be correct. I am assuming that you've seen something that says that. That would stand to reason.
There's a lot of material on the internet, Mr. Summers.
And I guess I'm not quite sure the court's question.
And that was a sexual assault, or was that a burglary that we're talking about?
That was a burglary. He was convicted.
He was not convicted of a sexual assault, was he?
No, that's what we've been arguing the whole time.
Well, that's what I'm trying to clean up here. One of the complaints was March 23rd, 03. The second complaint was March 26th, 03. The fourth degree sexual assault was March 23rd, 03, the alleged date of offense. The burglary and fifth-degree sexual assault charge was, the offense date alleged is March 26, 03. So 3 days apart, right? Two different events. The court's questioning, Mr. Summers, relates to how you interpret the statute of the timing of the convictions. That's number one. That's one reason for these questions. And the second reason for the question is that the one conviction to which you agree is second degree assault, but the second conviction was not a sexual assault, but a burglary. But the issue about whether this burglary matches the Wisconsin crime depends on the definition of burglary in Minnesota and in Wisconsin. And in Minnesota, how is burglary defined?
Your Honor, I am at a red light, but if you want me to respond, that is laid out in our brief. Minnesota has different elements. In Minnesota, for a burglary, it has to be, in Wisconsin, we have the additional element that it has to be with the intent
you have to, I guess in layman's terms, you have to basically go into a locked dwelling without the permission of the person there.
Doesn't it require either intent or actually committing a crime?
Minnesota does not. There is Minnesota does not have the additional element that we have in Wisconsin. That's on page 22 of my brief, and that is that you do not have in Minnesota, you do not have to have the intent to commit a felony or a theft to be convicted of
burglary. Chief, if I might, in the charge anyway, says, you know, that entering a dwelling without consent with intent to commit a crime or committed a crime while in the dwelling versus in Wisconsin, intent to commit a felony or committing a felony.
Right. So in Minnesota, you have it's an alternative, as I understand the Minnesota law, but we can recheck that.
Yes, actually, I actually did check it. That's why it's in my brief. There is a lower threshold in Minnesota, as put forth by the judge. In Minnesota, let's say if I just want to commit a misdemeanor, I committed that crime. That's not the way it is in this state. In this state, for burglary, it has to be the intent of what you committed two ways. Either one, a theft, or two, a felony. And that's lower thresholds. And in Minnesota, it's obvious that the fourth degree, let's say in Minnesota, if you went in there and you committed fourth degree sexual assault, it would be you would have committed that crime, burglary. You would not commit that, though, in this state.
Do you have to be convicted of a lesser crime in Minnesota?
In order
for burglary?
No, I believe that the jury would have to be told, I'm assuming it's like the same in this state. The jury would be told that they would have to find that you committed a crime.
Thank you, Mr. Summers. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ann Murphy, Assistant Attorney General, Counsel for the State of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. And may it please the court. I'm going to start briefly and go in order here with the issues raised by Mr. Long, by his attorney, in his argument. The first issues that he discussed today were regarding the sufficiency of the evidence to convict Mr. Long for the Wisconsin charges of second-degree sexual assault and false imprisonment. At trial in this case, the victim testified. And basically, I think the dispute revolves around her use of the word hug in her testimony, which word, incidentally, was actually first used by Mr. Long when, as a part of the incident, as testified to by the victim and in the criminal complaint, he asked the victim if he could hug her. She said no and tried to move away from him.
Ms. Murphy, I appreciate the sequence with which you planned your presentation. However, I would like to draw your attention to the repeater statute or the persistent repeater in section 939.62, sub 2M, subparagraph small b, subpart 1. More particularly, the latter half of that statute, which requires that the prior convictions take place in a certain order, or put another way, a certain sequence. I would like to know your view on how you see the relationship between the prior convictions that serve as the basis for the persistent repeater finding by Judge Vlatt, and how they correlate to the sequence which appear to be mandated by the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. Just to clarify, the sequence that you're talking about is found in which subsection of the statute?
That is the subsection which requires that the repeater is an actor who has been convicted of a serious felony on two or more separate occasions at any time preceding the serious felony for which he or she presently is being sentenced under Chapter 973, which convictions remain of record and unreversed. And now here's the pertinent part. Mm-hmm. And of the two or more previous convictions, at least one conviction occurred before the date of violation of at least one of the other felonies for which the actor was previously convicted.
Okay. As I think we went through during during Mr. Long's portion of the argument, the first conviction that was charged by the state and was found by the trial court to be a prior serious felony conviction that is unreversed was the Minnesota conviction, which I believe we went through this, occurred on March 23rd, and that occurred in Washington County, Minnesota. And he was convicted on January 7th, 2004, in Washington County after pleading to the charge of fourth-degree sexual misconduct, which Mr. Long has stated is not being contested as being a serious felony and comparable under the statute to second-degree sexual assault in Wisconsin based on the conduct that occurred and is alleged in the complaint. The second conviction
So that conviction date, the date we're focusing on, is January 7th, 2004. Is that correct?
Yes. So that, even though the conduct occurred 3 days prior, he was convicted.
Yeah.
Conviction. Later in a different court in Minnesota, in Washington County. The second occurrence was in Hennepin County, and that occurred on March 26, 2003. That was the charge brought by the Minnesota prosecutor was for felony burglary and fifth-degree sexual misconduct, which is a gross misdemeanor, as we discussed previously. In Minnesota, burglary is defined as intentional entry into the dwelling with intent to commit a crime therein. And at this time as well, there were other occupants of the dwelling present, and without consent, of course. He pled and was convicted of the felony burglary charge. The issue raised by Mr. Long related to that, as we've discussed, is that the underlying crime, which he was not convicted of, which I don't think is pertinent because we're looking at the conduct that occurred in that incident, was not a felony. And in Wisconsin, burglary is defined as intent, or you know, the entry into the dwelling place with intent to commit a felony. However, under the Collins case, the inquiry, and where there's a guilty plea or a no contest plea, Collins is very clear that the underlying conduct can be taken as admitted by the defendant that is alleged in the charging instrument. That is
correct. So did he plead to the same conduct in this burglary charge as was charged? My understanding, just so I'm clear, is that he pleaded to indecent exposure, which in my view is quite different than the facts that are alleged underlying the burglary charge. So if he pled to something different, where the factual basis is different, why are we looking at the complaint? That's what's bothering me. I don't know if you think it's relevant or not, but that's bothering me.
Your Honor, the relevant inquiry I think here is that he pled to the burglary charge, and the underlying facts of that were, as alleged in the complaint, were taken by the trial court here in making the determination that the conduct is comparable to second-degree sexual assault.
But the problem I have with that is that there was sexual conduct that was alleged underlying the burglary conviction, but that's not the sexual conduct to which he pled. In other words, exposing yourself is a lot different than the touching that was alleged, okay? So it's hard for me to say or to understand why I should use everything that's alleged in the Minnesota burglary complaint when you have an underlying criminal charge that he didn't plead to. Am I being clear about what's bothering me? Do you understand?
I understand, yes. Okay. I do understand what you are saying. I disagree, however, that he didn't plead to the charges that were in the complaint when he pled to the burglary charge.
Okay, so you're saying regardless of how he pled to the sexual conduct charge, which was underlying the burglary conviction, you still take all the facts that were alleged in the burglary conviction as true?
Yes, I believe that would be the correct statement of our position. And that is based on Collins, this court's, and also this court's recent decision, which is, you know, the facts and underlying arguments were different, but in LeCount, where this court adopted the language from the Apprendi case from the U.S. Supreme Court, that the in a plea of guilty or no contest, the charging instrument can be used to establish the underlying facts.
I wouldn't have any trouble if, in fact, he pled to the same sexual conduct that underlies the burglary conviction. I think that's consistent. I see a difference when you plead to a different underlying crime. What did he plead to the underlying sexual charge?
In the Minnesota Hennepin County, Minnesota case, he pled to the burglary charge.
Right.
And I'm not clear if he pled to indecent exposure. I heard you mention
that's
that.
That's what I thought he pled to.
I don't think that that is in the record, but my understanding is that the only thing he was convicted of in that case,
yes,
based on the judgment of conviction, was the burglary charge.
That's my point.
Okay, thank you.
Exactly, no point. The point is...
He has multiple convictions for, things like indecent exposure, but I believe in that Hennepin County case of that issue, the only thing he pled to was the felony burglary.
And I think the only conviction you have on record here in the Hennepin County case is burglary.
Yes.
And so what you do is you have a conviction of burglary, and the underlying complaint has two misdemeanors in it. Is that right?
I believe it was only one. It was
one.
The 15-degree sexual misconduct.
Well, not the indecent exposure.
The underlying complaint, I have it right here.
Doesn't make any difference, because
I don't know if it makes a difference.
If indecent exposure was a misdemeanor, that would have been good enough in Minnesota, apparently, for burglary.
For burglary, apparently it would be, yes, because it requires intent to commit a crime.
Right. So, and crime, I'm assuming, but don't know, that crime is defined in Minnesota as both misdemeanor and felon. Is that right?
Yes, I believe that it would be correct.
Could I ask you, we talked about the dates of these Minnesota offenses.
Yes.
And one was on March 23rd, 2003. That's the sexual assault, sexual conduct, or whatever, however they phrase it. March 23rd, 2003. And then we had the cluster of offenses on March 26, 2003. What conviction for a serious felony occurred before the violation, one of those violations?
The way I read the section of 939.62 is that the prior convictions must have occurred before the third conviction.
How do you read that?
Before the date of the violation of at least one of the other felonies for which the actor was previously convicted. I mean, I think the sequence here...
Let's read the statute.
Okay.
At least one conviction occurred before the date of violation of at least one of the other felonies for which the actor was previously convicted. Explain your reading of that.
So in this case, the conviction occurred on March 23rd, and that was the...
The offense occurred on March 23rd.
The offense occurred, so at least one of the convictions occurred before the date of the violation. Ooh, that is complicated.
Well, we're talking about two things in
the
statute. One is conviction and one is violation. At least one conviction occurred before the date of violation, at least one of the other felonies. I'm not seeing the conviction.
You're correct. Both convictions in this case occurred... Both prior convictions in this case occurred after the date of both violations in the Minnesota cases. But they are both prior serious felony convictions, the state argues, which occurred before the date of this violation that he's currently been convicted of in Wisconsin.
what is the court to do? If I read that phrase, at least one conviction. Let me take the Washington County conviction. That was dated January 7th, 2004. Occurred before the date of violation. I'll take Hennepin County. That was March 26, 2003. January 04 is not before March 03, so that can't work, right? Let me reverse them. Let me take the first conviction, and focusing on, because we've got conviction and violation. Let me say the conviction I want to focus on is the Hennepin County conviction. And that conviction date was December 03. And the violation date of Washington County is March of 03. Well, that's not before either. So the way I read it, neither event, we don't have the prerequisite timing in this case. So what should we do about that?
I think that the reading of the statute that we're talking about is somewhat convoluted and doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you're looking at the purpose of this statute. But
so I'll tell you why. Because I think there's an argument to be made that the three strikes law is to deal with someone who has serious offenses over a period of time. That's why there's a sequence here. As opposed to someone who's off their meds for a week and engages in, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday sort of offense. That there's that for three strikes, which after all is going to cause, put the defendant here, I don't know, 35 years old, do I regret, you know, life in prison, paid by the taxpayers, without parole as a possibility. And so I think this law, at least arguably, isn't for the person who's off his meds for a week or a month, but rather taking someone who over a sequence, a period of times, has engaged in serious felonies. Do you think that's the purpose?
Your Honor, the history of the statute, there's not a lot of legislative history, a possibility. I wouldn't dispute that. However, I don't think in this particular case it's applicable. I don't think that, and I can say with some certainty based on my research into the past criminal history and the recidivist elements that are present here, that Mr. Long was someone who just committed a couple offenses within a week and then did nothing for several years.
What you have charged here.
Yes.
Let's say my interpretation is correct in terms of the sequence, the dates that I gave you, that there is no conviction before a date of violation. Let's say I'm correct. What should I do about that?
If I may, I think there is another way to look at it. I mean, this persistent repeater statute applies only after a conviction, correct? We're not going to get to this statute unless Mr. Long, which he was convicted in Wisconsin. It's a sentencing statute. The previously convicted language in there then could apply to, in this case, the third offense, which the violation occurred after the date of the two prior ones. And he was convicted, obviously, you know, about a year and a half or so afterwards.
And I understand that's another interpretation. Mm-hmm. Let's say my interpretation is the interpretation as seen by four justices on this court. Sometimes that happens, sometimes it doesn't happen. What should we do? What should we do with this case?
What should you do with this case? If you interpret the statute that the convictions are not
to the date of violation.
Okay. I think that the remedy in that case would be resentencing of Mr. Long. I mean, I don't think you can reverse. I mean, we haven't discussed much the sufficiency of the evidence argument, but I think, assuming that this court can affirm the findings of the jury that there was sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Long of both charges, but then if you find that the persistent repeater statute cannot apply because two of his three prior convictions were, the violations occurred before the date of...
Should we say, waiver? There wasn't any argument made about
that. That argument was not made, you're correct.
Should we do that?
I have not researched the issue, but it seems to me that is a possible outcome because that was not raised at the trial court level or at the appellate level. on any front. So the fact that he was, the only argument that's being made at this time is that the conduct that occurred in the Minnesota conviction was not sufficient to sentence him under this persistent repeater section, could result in a waiver of that argument that his convictions were not, the violations occurred not in the correct order under the statute.
Ms. Murphy, if I might, let me take a little different tact here. I'm thinking about the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Apprendi. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, and I'm going to do this shorthand-wise, but basically what that case means to me is that where there's a penalty enhancer, where there are facts that have to be determined in regard to whether to apply or not apply the penalty enhancer, those facts are to be found by a jury. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court backed away a little bit in Shepard. In Shepard, they begin to talk in terms of using reliable court documents to bolster, if you will, to assist in making the determination in regard to whether a penalty enhancer was applicable. In LeCount, which was a case decided, I think the last term, if not the term before, we said a pre-sentence report is a reliable court document that could be utilized. What gives me pause here is I understand that what was being used was complaints, copies of complaints from Minnesota. Do you think those fit the requirements of Shepard?
Your Honor, I do think that they fit the requirements of Shepard.
Why?
Specifically, in that case and in the LeCount case, the language used involved the charging instrument in the case, that is a sufficient, where there's a guilty plea or where the defendant pleads to the underlying charge, the charging instrument can be used to prove those underlying facts. That is exactly what we have here. And that was submitted by the state in the trial court, and the trial court used those admitted to facts, and those have never been disputed by Mr. Long, to make that determination under Collins that the conduct in Minnesota was comparable to the serious felony of second-degree sexual assault in Wisconsin.
And it's your understanding of the sentencing hearing here that the defendant was not arguing about the reliability or applicability of those complaints?
Correct, Your Honor. There was never an argument made about the use of those complaints as proof of the underlying facts, and never a dispute as to the underlying facts in the Minnesota case.
Either by him or by counsel.
I'm sorry?
Either by the defendant himself or by counsel. There was no argument.
Correct. There was no argument to that effect. So the state's position on the persistent repeater statute, just to kind of go over what we have discussed, and I understand the court's concern about the language, but I do find it possible under the language that we've discussed and gone around about that we can consider his third conviction to be a prior conviction. He's being sentenced at this point. He's been convicted, and the conduct and the violation in that conviction, this particular conviction in Wisconsin, occurred in late 2006, obviously after the convictions in Minnesota, the two prior convictions. So sequentially, it can fit. More importantly, perhaps, the more substantive argument here than the only argument that has been made by Mr. Long is that his conduct in the Minnesota burglary conviction was not sufficient to be found to be comparable to the Wisconsin offense of second-degree sexual assault, which is a serious felony in Wisconsin. The legislature has determined that that is one of the offenses under the three strikes law that can constitute a predicate offense and a serious felony.
Why don't we go through the conduct during that burglary, and you tell us why that is second-degree sexual assault in Wisconsin. It's my understanding here that this individual is is in an apartment building, and the individual asks a young woman to expose her the rear part of her anatomy. She does not do that, and he grabs her pants, pulls them down, and pinches her. Is that right? Now, that is second-degree sexual assault in Wisconsin, in your view?
Your Honor, I would refine your recitation of the facts somewhat. There's a little more to it than that. First of all, just to note, the trial court made its finding that this was comparable beyond a reasonable doubt to second-degree sexual assault. It noted that the conduct in all three of these incidents was strikingly similar. There are remarkable similarities between the conduct, which was found in the first Minnesota incident, or I guess the second to be convicted, but the Washington County incident, no dispute that that's second-degree sexual assault. Remarkable similarities to what occurred in Wisconsin to the 18-year-old hotel desk clerk. And what happened was, in this Hennepin County case, he followed two women into their apartment and began making advances and asking if he could hug them. Use of that word again. They said, no, get out of our apartment. And he left, came back, doesn't say how long, but, you know, within a period of time, entered without consent, and entered their dwelling while they were there, and then began to do some other lewd acts, such as, you know, exposing himself, pulling down his pants, masturbating in front of them, and he was told repeatedly, get out, get out, get out, and also, you know, asked if he could see her private parts, her buttocks, because it would help him achieve his goal. And at that point, she said no, and he grabbed her pants, pulled them down, and the words of the complaint are grabbed her buttocks. There's no pinching or slapping that was alleged in the complaint and was admitted to by Mr. Long. So it's a grabbing. It's a forceful act. And I find it very difficult to understand how we could not find that that is second-degree sexual assault, a grabbing, a forceful act. The elements in Wisconsin are sexual contact by use of force and without consent. And the trial court found beyond a reasonable doubt that all three were present here. And that's the state's position in this case, that was a correct finding, and that that type of conduct, if it had occurred in Wisconsin, would have been charged with second-degree sexual assault. It's comparable under Collins, and it would have constituted the third conviction for a serious felony, and it does constitute the third conviction for a serious felony in this case, because the out-of-state conviction was sufficient and was comparable to second-degree sexual assault in Wisconsin.
You have to establish the use or threat of force or violence. So, is the grabbing of the pants use of threat or force or violence?
I would say there's two, the grabbing of the pants and the grabbing of the buttocks. That and under Bonds, I mean, the force can be the force used to make sexual contact. And that is what occurred here when it was the grabbing and pulling down and grabbing of buttocks. And that is a sexual contact, and it is use of force. Therefore, under our three strikes law enacted by the legislature with the express purpose of enhancing punishment for recidivist felons, Mr. Long has been convicted on three prior occasions, on two prior occasions and on this current occasion, of a serious felony as defined by the statute, explicitly defined by the statute to include second-degree sexual assault, sexual contact by use of force without the consent of the victim. And therefore, the convictions are sufficient to apply the persistent repeater statute to him as found by the trial court and the Court of Appeals, and this court should affirm that finding.
In light of the court's questioning about the meaning of the statutory text, does the state wish to brief that issue?
If the court would find a supplemental brief helpful, the state would agree to do that. That did not, as we've noted, that was not argued and did not, come up in any of the prior briefings. But if that's something that would be helpful to the court, the state would agree to that.
Did the trial court or the Court of Appeals were they ever asked to rule on that issue? Or is it just today that we're first discussing that?
Just today that we're first discussing that. That's not been raised, it has not been argued or decided previously.
If on March 23rd, 2003, the defendant had committed three indisputably serious felonies in Minnesota and had been convicted of all three of them, would that be enough to satisfy the persistent repeater statute?
I would say under the argument that I've made here today, it would be, because the conviction, and then obviously then there would be a conviction here in Wisconsin, would be that violation, the Wisconsin violation, which the defendant would have been convicted of, occurred after the violations on March 23rd, three violations on March 23rd. So you would have four in that case, but you would have the sequential order under the statute that there were prior felonies and then a violation occurred in the current one. That makes up the three.
Chief, I would ask for briefs on this subject.
Well, that will be discussed by the court, and a decision as to briefs will, of course, be sent to both of you. The issue is at least one conviction occurred. This is on the Minnesota. Before the date of violation of at least one of the other felonies. So, I mean, that is the issue that is, I think, that Justice Prosser is raising in his question as to the statement there. I would, if you are asked to brief this, if you are asked, you would look at legislative history, and the Legislative Reference Bureau does have an analysis of the bill, which the court has in the past looked at, and it's an analysis by the Legislative Reference Bureau, 1993 Senate Bill 781. I do not mean when I cite that to indicate that is the only reference. I mean to cite it as one possible reference to be examined. Thank you, Ms. Murphy.
Your Honor.
Mr. Summers.
If I may be so bold, I don't think we need to brief it because I think the rule of lenity should kick in.
Only if the court finds it ambiguous.
Well, right, but it would seem to me that a reasonable person could at least come up with the interpretation that has been put forth. Obviously, at least a couple of judges today or more have expressed that was their, let's say, possible in interpretation. So if the judges find that's a reasonable person could see it that way, then I believe then that the rule of lenity should kick in.
Why shouldn't waiver kick in? The rule of waiver kick in.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I wouldn't think that out for a second. What would be being said then is that we should have a man in prison for the rest of his life, even though we say the law does not permit him to do so. That would be such a gross injustice, I guess. I just can't imagine that seven judges would go along with a man being in prison for the rest of his life on a law that they would agree should not be applied to him. So the interest of justice, I think, would have to be used or would have to be considered by this court.
Why shouldn't we decide the issues that you've brought before the court and remand it for the Court of Appeals, or rather the trial court to consider that issue, since the trial court never had a chance to pass on it in the first instance?
Because I think it would be an abdication of this court's responsibility. If this court basically is, this isn't a game of gotcha. Hey, this attorney made a mistake, that judge made a mistake. This is actually supposed to be about the law, defining the law, and what is just. And if this court has determined that it's reasonable for one to interpret the statute that way, then this court should just follow that through. They should apply what is already the Wisconsin law and say that the persistent repeater statute
Mr.
should
Summers,
not apply.
If it's not a question of gotcha, why wouldn't you simply agree to give her some time, give the other side time to brief it, if it's not a question of gotcha?
Your Honor, it doesn't matter. There's no reason to give them time once you realize what the rule of lenity is. The rule of lenity says if it's reasonable for a defendant to have that perspective, it applies automatically. So it doesn't matter what arguments under the law she could come up with. It doesn't matter, period, because once the rule of lenity is applied, that means under the law, you are supposed to rule in favor of the defendant. I didn't come up with the rule of lenity. That's the Wisconsin law. It has been the Wisconsin law for some period of time. And so once this court has found that it should be applied, that should be the end of it. There's no reason to get any more information from her or from
counsel. At oral argument, rarely, if ever, does the court make decisions. The court hasn't found ambiguity. Court hasn't made any findings.
I understand.
Court asked questions. Your response is, hey, to come up with an issue and a problem, you may have to apply the rule of lenity. Justice Bradley asks you, why shouldn't we apply the rule of waiver? Many issues are waived in criminal court, either by the state or by the defendant.
I understand that, but again, we're talking about a situation where a man will be in prison for the rest of his life. This court does have power to act in the interest of justice.
And if there was power to ignore a waiver or a forfeiture.
Right. The court has the power to act in the interest of justice, too. There's the specific power that the court has granted to it. And if that would not be the interest of justice, I can't imagine any situation where the interest of justice would apply.
I asked some questions of your opposing counsel about whether the events in Minnesota added up to second-degree sexual assault. She made a pretty good argument that there was violence, force. What's your rebuttal?
Actually, I don't think she made any argument at all, Your Honor. And again, when she did it, she almost was bound to. When she did it, actually, she was almost bound to go beyond the bare bones words of the complaint. The fact of the matter is in the Minnesota complaint, for the element of the use of force, or the threat of use of force, all that you have is that it says, pull down her pants, grab her butt. That's it. You don't have anything beyond that whatsoever. Now, again, that's the argument that I had made earlier when I first began. What are you talking about? Are you saying this is force just because someone grabbed somebody on the wrist? Basically, that's it. That's all that you have. And to go along with that, just Justice Rogensack had asked, he was not convicted of that misdemeanor sexual charge on the Minnesota complaint. I've had a chance to look at it. He wasn't. And I'd also put forward the argument that these events are remarkably similar is a broad brush that overlooks the actual cryptic language. And I said there's no way beyond a reasonable doubt that bare bones phrase, pull down her pants, grab her butt, would be enough to say that he committed, beyond a reasonable doubt, second-degree sexual assault in this state. And that's all that I have. I see that my time is up.
Good, counsel.
Thank you.
I want to thank Mr. Summers and Ms. Murphy for their arguments today on a review of the repeat offender rule. And that ends our discussion and hearing on 07AP2307CR State versus Long. Should the court want briefs, we will advise counsel. Thank you very much. We will take a short recess so that the students who are here may leave and other students may enter the courtroom. We are in recess.